Good evening. This is Mae Brussel, February the 16th, 1979, in Carmel, California, and this is tape number 376. In Time Magazine, September the 5th, 1932, you may want to copy that. I'm giving you the date of it. There's an article under the title of Germany about the elections and the political controversies going on in Germany in 1932. And it says, up and down Germany, the question flashed last week. Had Adolf Hitler gone crazy? Had his nerves given way? Was he really in a straitjacket, jittering in the Bavarian asylum? No, Adolf Hitler was fishing on a river in a brook. His sister was boiling the trout. He was having a delicious supper. And Adolf Hitler was doing just fine. Then it goes on to explain that there was pressure against Adolf Hitler because of a series of political assassinations that he had been linked with, Handsome Adolf, in Germany. This is 1932. And the von Papen regime, the von Schleicher-Papen regime, was behind them 100% in their determination to put an end to these political assassinations. Then the article goes on under the subtitle of Gumbel, the Nazis had won victory for the week. The fascist students at Heidelberg succeeded in getting fired Professor Emil J. Gumbel, who had announced in a lecture that a turnip is better than a war memorial. One doesn't become popular, said he, by saying that a popular policy will lead to a country to catastrophe, especially if the events have been shown to be true. There's no question I'm a pacifist, said Professor Gumbel. The war made me that, and I'm an anti-fascist, and I'm in favor of the Republic. But Emil Gumbel's real crime, his real dynamite, were three books that he published between 1919 and 1922. One called 4 Years of War Lies, the other 2 Years of Political Murders, 4 Years of Political Assassinations. And in these two books, he proved that over 400 political assassinations had taken place up until 1932, and the Minister of Justice admitted that this had been true. They didn't deny that these assassinations were taking place. I turned on to Mr. Gumbel through computer and automations. Edmund Barclay has been warning about fascism in this country. And as I see our leaping, galloping fascism with the electoral process going on and with the murder of Rockefeller at this time, I want to tell you that all of this happened before exactly the way it did in Germany. And because the Germans were brought to the United States and because the Americans financed Hitler, there isn't any reason not to follow what they did before to understand the present. Computer and Automation in September 1970 talked about the books that Gumbel wrote and the murders in 1923 and 1932. In Germany, and he said it's important to confirm that there was a pattern of political assassinations in a number of historical situations, and these occurred from World War I until Hitler became Chancellor of the Reich, of the German Reich, in 1932. That's just after the Time magazine was written. In 1933, Hitler was the Führer. The illegal military groups were a group of fanatic terrorist organizations. They supported illegal armaments after World War I. And the main thing about the murders, in addition to having the people murdered that would make political changes or change Germany, say, towards a pacifist line instead of heading us towards a Holocaust that eventually killed 80 million people and displaced about 20 million more, was the insidious role of the law courts. The political assassinations committed by members of the former Imperial and secret armies put a burden of administration on the justice. The murderers had to be acquitted, and the victims always had to be shown guilty. Or at least the people that doing the murders were acquitted or never tried, and they got off. And the role of the courts went all the way down from the sentencing to the prosecution to the equivalent of the Supreme Court. The witnesses that were called were witnesses that worked for the police teams. And the judges, the police, and he lists the ways by which the courts could be altered. I mentioned this, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago on Dialogue Conspiracy, but it's been so long that I want to share it with people, new people who have been taking the tapes in the last couple of years. I don't think I have read this to you before. And I bring it out, maybe I should read it every week, because of the big changes that are taking place in this country. They've been going on since the end of World War II, just as they went on in Germany at the end of the Versailles Treaty. But they're escalating now, and I think the way the person named Howard Hughes was handled and Nelson Rockefeller was handled is symbolic of treatment of men at the very highest level who had control being knocked off, because if you know that they're being taken away, there's not much chance for the lowly working person or the minorities, the blacks or children or the aged or the mentally sick. When you can experiment and remove people with such high power, then you know how much consideration they're going to have for you. Even their own working teams over and over again have to be murdered. Last week I talked about that airplane crash in Virginia where Mr. Obershane was killed, and the Federal National Transportation Safety Board wouldn't release the name of the pilot. But there was a name in the Washington Post. The pilot was Richard Neal, 42, who died with an instructor, but it turns out that the pilot had a medical certificate that expired 3 months before the crash, that he failed to maintain adequate flying hours in the plane to be qualified by the Federal Aviation Administration. The instructor, Mr. Edlin, who was with him, was not qualified to give instrument landing on this particular plane. And they were flying a kind of an airplane for which they had less than two hours experience in that type of aircraft. And Mr. Neal, the pilot, had donated his time to Mr. Obershane. And then the Washington Post said the crash triggered a number of accounts of near disasters for candidates who find it necessary to fly around portions of Virginia to run for office. Now, see, I've noticed a large number of candidates and near deaths, and we've mentioned on other tapes that airplane crash at PSA down in San Diego, and Lieutenant Governor Dimley was supposed to be on that plane, and I link this to the Virginia plane. Well, these are the kinds of assassinations that are important because they're never thoroughly investigated, but the man who won the seat from Mr. Obershane, as I mentioned before, was John Warner, former Secretary of the Navy, who claimed that then he won the senatorial election because he had come out for segregation in the Navy. And that's the kind of murders that you add up and up and up and get to this number 400 before we get the Fuhrer in. And, of course, I think that the Fuhrer is going to be Ronald Reagan, the mild-mannered, or John Connally or Mr. Haig. You have a few choices at the very highest level. But there's nothing different than what went on in Germany, and I'm going right into Rockefeller. I just have three more things to announce, and we'll talk about the death of Nelson Rockefeller. New West had an article, this was just before they went out of business, I guess their last issue, and it says, Evel Younger joins La Costa's law firm. Some of you who have my tapes have two tapes on Evel Younger, and I said hold on to them and play them, because when the Republicans win in 1980, he'll be one of the first people to get an appointment. But in the meantime, he's down with the law office in Los Angeles. He didn't win as governor of California, but never fear, Younger is too healed into the military takeover plan, the garden plot, and the intelligence operation to not be useful very soon. But right now he's in a law firm of Buchholder, Niemer, Fields, and Christy, which represented La Costa, this San Diego spa that's involved in a lawsuit magazine with Penthouse. This lawsuit has gone on for about 3 years with the allegations La Costa is linked to organized crime. And Mo Dallas is one of the, I think he's one of the owners of La Costa. Mo Dallas of organized crime came from Las Vegas down to La Costa, and he shared his house in Vegas and was very close and friendly with Robert Mayhew from the Howard Hughes organization when they were setting up the assassination teams in the United States. And, of course, Robert Blakey of the House Select Committee on Assassinations was a character witness for Mo Dallas in the Penthouse trial defending Mo Dallas. So it's just very natural that Evel Younger, who never prosecuted organized crime in California, and he was very easy on them. In fact, this article says, after Younger took office, he ordered his investigators to take La Costa informants off the state payroll. He had them on the state payroll, but he never did much investigation of crime the entire time that he was the governor or the district attorney in Los Angeles. And, of course, he was the one who prosecuted the Sirhan case and covered up the Mayhew Vegas Hughes connections to that. So So Ethel Younger is now at a firm that has been charged with representing organized crime members, and he's been with them. So watch him surface in the back until, as I say, a Republican is elected, and then we'll have Mr. Younger back with us. There's another article I want to share with you. I don't want to lose it. It's about a house that's being sold in Washington, D.C. This is Washington Post, February the 6th, 1979. It says CIA puts its Eastern Shore Safe House Mansion on sale. Now, this is about an eight-bedroom house, eight bedrooms and six bathrooms, that was used as a safe house when Gary Powers came home from the Soviet Union. His plane was down, and remember, he was supposed to be embarrassing the United States because it brought off the peace treaty that President Eisenhower wanted with Khrushchev. And Powers' name I've mentioned in regards to Lee Harvey Oswald and those two John Paisley tapes that I did several weeks ago. Well, Gary Powers didn't embarrass the United States and didn't suffer. He was taken to a 79-acre spread where they have boats in the harbor. You can come in through a boat or sailboats in placid waters, a baronial home, and so forth. This huge, it's a seven-bedroom home. It's been used by the CIA in 1962, and when Powers came home, he stayed there. There's 4,000 feet of shoreline, and there's a manor house. The CIA is selling it. Now, the asking price is at least $350,000, but knowing how real estate go, I think that's because the General Accounting Office handles the sale of that house. Otherwise, this kind of an estate with 79 acres and this many rooms and baths would probably be a $2 or $3 million home. And one of the things I didn't bring out on my tapes of Yuri Nosenko and John Paisley and Lee Harvey Oswald was the fact that when the House Select Committee on Assassination said that Yuri Nosenko, the defector from the Soviet Union, was put in a house, and then they put him in a vault and built a great big house around him. I could see Yuri Nosenko at a very private estate living off the hog. He was given almost $1 million in 1968 after his, in quotes, captivity. Now, I saw Yuri Nosenko not living anything like they said he did outside of Washington and being favored and babied because he had worked with the CIA and was a double agent in the KGB. So when this article came out this week, it said that since 1962, they haven't said what this property was used for. It was built in 1930. It has a chained entrance, and it says no trespassing, and it was used for secret purposes. It was quiet. Everything they did there was quiet. And after the Powers incident, this is from the Washington Post, the CIA never said what they did with the place. They used it for Gary Powers, but then they said they'd never be able to use it again. So the home's history after 1962 becomes shrouded in secrecy. It was used for training. Training for what? Well, that's classified, they said. Now, I would bet you a good hunk of my political research that that is the house that Yuri Nosenko is taken to, this beautiful eight-bedroom, seven-bathroom home, 79 acres, 4,000 feet of shoreline. And there's a photograph. It's in Talbot County, Maryland, on the Choptank River. And that's where Yuri Nosenko stayed after Gary Powers stayed there. I bet you Nosenko was in that house. And then in 1968, he was moved, given a new identity, and he's North Carolina. I don't believe they put him through all those tortures. I think it makes good news, and it was a diversionary. But this house hasn't been admittedly used since 62, when it was used for Gary Powers, so it would be a perfect place to use. One more article about Mr. Khomeini, an important article, not about him alone, but how he got his power. And I got this from the National Labor Caucus. There's an article, Is Khomeini Revolt a Blood Feud? And there's a story of how he came to power, but there was a sentence in here that is terribly important because this is what it says. It says, Khomeini had not given up when he was kicked out of in 1963 when the Shah had a referendum, what he called his white revolution, and so forth. Khomeini counteracted in June with riots, and immediately the Shah had Khomeini arrested. The army opened fire. 10,000 people were killed, and so forth. But Khomeini, it says, had not given up. Every day, he launched calls for rebellion against the Shah. Khomeini was certainly the first to use a new weapon. in the subversion war, cassettes. C-A-S-S-E-T-T-E-S. Thousands of cassettes containing his calls were made in Lebanon or Libya and shipped to Iran. Now, I emphasize and spell this out for you because I have a very close friend who went to Europe to live. He realized that this country was going fascist in 1970. That was about the time that I was ready to leave for Canada, and then we had the accident in the family. And I stayed back here and retrenched what we were doing here. We couldn't leave at the time. After Bonnie was killed, and Barbara was in the hospital, and I stayed home. And I have this friend who I met about that time, and then he went over to Africa, and he went to Middle East, and he was in China, he went into Cuba, and he mastered a large number of languages, and he made up his mind he was going to find out what was going on in the world, and the only way he could find out was to speak the native tongue. And then he came back here in about 1974, and he had attended oil conferences in Sweden. He'd been in Paris, and he got into meetings. He could speak the languages, and he went to the meetings, and he's been a source of information to me. And I had been on KLRB since 1971, and he said, "May, make tape cassettes and send them out over the world, because people all over have these little machines, these little boxes. You wouldn't believe it. They have nothing else. They have no cars, no televisions, no radios. They have that little transistor, that tape cassette. They're manufactured cheap over there. They're coming in from Japan." And he had been in Africa and North Africa. And he said, "Put your message on cassette and spread it around the world so the people will have the history and know what is happening." And I didn't do that. I was on the air until last June. Well, the tapes, the reels, were available. We were mailing out the reels and I suppose some cassettes for a while, but not on a regular basis like now. But the main thing is that we are going into a terrible period of turmoil, and people want answers, and they want to know where to get facts, and they want to be able to put these things together. And I know you people do, because you subscribe. That's the first step in, you know. That's the first part of the swimming, is to get in the water. But you have to take these cassettes that you have. There's no copyright. Copy them. Send them all over. Send them to 10 people. You could buy 3 for a dollar. They sell cheaper at drugstores and so forth. I get the master copies here. But for you listeners, and many of you are doing this now, spread it. You don't have to tell me who receives them. I'm getting mail, and I'm answering questions from people all over the world, and I do have a distributor in London now. We sent out $100 worth of tapes to a man in Australia, and there's some in Ireland. And the main thing is, get the message going by the tape cassette so it permeates the thinking of this country that there are these murders. These murders are taking place. And as we get closer to war, people will listen to you better. They'll listen to me better on the radio now than they did 3 or 4 years ago. As the inflation goes up, as the gasoline's taken away, and you can't afford food or heating or education or health, and when your friends can't afford these things, they'll catch on. And if you read the newspapers, front pages just today, the Mexicans rebuke Carter's vow of respect. They, as much as said to him yesterday, "How can we relate to you? You people are sleazy in your dealings, and we can't trust you, and you wouldn't deal with us with our natural gas until you found out how much oil we had, and then you come running to us like you're our long buddies in Mexico," is really telling the president off, which was that that's what 77 countries should have done and never did up to this point. There's a mystery disease in Naples, 64 babies in Naples, 910 in Jonestown. There'll be mystery diseases all over the world. Americans in Iran fear serious violence unless they flee. Americans in every country are going to feel violence, and other countries are watching and taking off from there. Another headline this morning, Turkey will fall as Iran did. You bet your booties it's going to be Nicaragua, Guatemala, Chile, Paraguay, Uruguay, Honduras, Dominican Republic, Haiti. The whole world is watching Iran, because the Savak and the Shah had the ultimate in power. They had the ultimate in greed. They had the ultimate in United States support. The president going over there and dancing his New Year's Eve party with the Shah a year ago this New Year's. We gave them everything they needed. And when it was time to get them out because of the exploitation and the imperialism, the way we were grabbing their oil for our needs and keeping them at slave labor with a court that was identical to Nazi Germany and torturing machines cutting off arms, legs, fingers, and head, garroting at the collar, manufactured in the USA, training police in Washington and in Texas for all over the world. Those countries are watching. Also today, U.S. arms cost $22 billion. You can't even visualize what that figure is, and neither could I, but it's more than we need for weapons at this time, and the weapons aren't going to do any good. But now we're going to get back to Rockefeller, because all of this is brewing and taking place now, and because I'm convinced Nelson Rockefeller was murdered, I want to go into as much as we have time for, because he was another of the big cookies. He was the biggest one, and people always feared the Rockefeller family. I said, no, it's the Reagan machine that has the power, the Reagan-Conley machine, the Hagues that have the power. It's not the Nelson Rockefellers. And the truth is, now one sister is dead, another two brothers are dead, Nelson is dead, there's just Lawrence and David left. And because of this scandal and all the blackmailing, they're going to have to sit very close to their banking desk, and they're not going to be the wheelers and dealers that they used to be. Well, they'll still continue the best they can, but it'll never be the same again. Now, the given facts on the Rockefeller murder, I'm just going to run off very quickly, and I'm going to spend all the rest of the time on questions that should be answered for grand jury or police, and show you the comparisons between here and Chappaquiddick and Germany. Nelson Rockefeller, as I say, was a political figure. He was controversial. And the lies began the moment he died. And that's what I want to go into, because Hugh Morrow, his press secretary, worked for him 35 years. So I don't think that he was a plant from the Defense Department or the CIA, such as Megan Marshak, who only worked 4 years. But he worked 35 years, and he lied from the very beginning. So they had something on Rockefeller, and they had something on what Chana Pierce and Megan were doing, what Rockefeller was doing with that house at 25 West 54th Street. That forced Mr. Morrow to lie and break this thing right from the beginning, off on the wrong course. It's like trying to, you know, make a poached egg and you break the shell and drop it on the floor. You can't put it together again. And the Rockefeller story obviously was not meant to be put together again. Hugh Morrow met outside the hospital and told us that Rockefeller died at Rockefeller Center. And that's where the trouble started. And then he went to the apartment of Megan Marshak at 25 West 54th Street, and he was there at 4 a.m. in the morning when Associated Press had called her for the part of the story. So the cover-up was then, and the lies started. The lie of where he was, the lie first that he was with his chauffeur, and that was wrong. He was with the chauffeur and the security guard. Then that was wrong. They said he wasn't at the townhouse. He was at the townhouse. He wasn't at Rockefeller Center. Another lie. Then they said he wasn't with the chauffeur, but he was with a guard and a special aide that he works with. Then that was wrong. He wasn't with the guard. He was only with the aide. The aide was a 31-year-old woman. Then that was wrong. She wasn't 31. She was 21. And then she wasn't 21. She was 25. Then they said an unidentified woman called the ambulance. That was wrong. Then they said it wasn't an unidentified woman. It was his aide, Megan Marshak. Then that was wrong. Then they said it wasn't Megan. It was Poinchetta Pierce that called the emergency. And then they said he died at 11:15, and that was wrong. He died at 10:15. Then Poinchetta came in and said he died at 10. She got a call at 10:50 to come down, and he died at 11:15, and that was wrong. And then they came back and said he died at 10:15, and that there was an hour elapse. You can add that many lies up in that many days if you followed it consecutively. He owned the apartment where the cooperative apartment, or the main building it was, on 25 West 54th Street that Megan Marshak lived. She lived just several doors down from where his place was on 13 West 54th Street. He gave her $45,000 to buy the apartment. Mrs. Rockefeller, as a co-owner of the building, approved of her moving in there into that building. She made $60,000 a year. She had unlimited expense account. She, in quotes, helped write Rockefeller's speeches. She worked on his book. She arranged dinner parties. She's described in one article as the jack of all trades. And also she was on duty 24 hours a day. A chauffeur drove Rocky to his apartment with a aide named Andrew Hoffman. Their chauffeur went around the corner and parked on 55th Street. The doorman knew where to get him. But at that point, Andrew Hoffman disappears or goes in with Rocky. That is what we'll never know. That's one of the questions that is primary to this case. Where did Andrew Hoffman go? Because when Poichette appears, came down and got a call from Megan, Rocky had had a heart attack. Megan was alone with Rocky. But when the ambulance arrived, not when the police came in, when the two policemen came in at 11:16, 11:17, Megan was alone with Rocky. But when the ambulance came in at 11:22, Andrew Hoffman came in to Rocky's house there, the aide. So there's a missing time period from 9 to 11:17. And if Megan Marshak hired the staff, there's an article that she hired that staff for him. Did she hire Hoffman? And the point is, was he in the building hiding somewhere? It was a 5 floors, and Rockefeller could have said, you know, go on upstairs. Was he out on the streets? Was he with Poichette 2 doors down? He was holding a walkie-talkie microphone and telling the ambulance drivers to go to Lenox Hill Hospital, which was 22 blocks away. And they said, no, we have to go to Roosevelt Hospital, which is over here on 51st Street and 8th, which is 4 blocks away. We go to the nearest hospital. And Andrew Hoffman says, but you don't know who this is. This is Nelson Rockefeller. And they went 22 blocks instead. But when the ambulance drivers came in, they both said that they saw a man out on the street with a walkie-talkie. And they knew it was important that something was going on, that he had a walkie-talkie and was talking to someone, and they didn't know who he was. But then they identified Andrew Hoffman inside with a walkie-talkie. So whether it was that man with disguise or a hat or glasses, they didn't recognize, who then came in and ordered the body to the Lenox Hill Hospital, because that's the important connecting link right there. Where was Andrew Hoffman? Now, there's a series of possibilities that I have listed, that either he was in the house, there are 5 stories there, and he could possibly have helped kill Nelson Rockefeller. He could have, I am not charging with murder. I'm saying the grand jury should investigate the possibility, because the possibilities are A, that Nelson Rockefeller was injected and died, similar to a Jonestown cyanide. If there's a hole in his arm, you never saw it, because Dr. Eshakoff was at the hospital. He had been phoned, and nobody knows who phoned him. We brought that up last week, and I talked about Andrew Hoffman last week. He could be injected and taken. Was Hoffman in the house? There are 5 floors. Megan hired the staff. Was he over at Megan's apartment with Poichette Pierce? Or was he out on the streets till Poichette got word? Once Megan called Poichette and said, come on over here. Once Poichette goes out on the street from the number 25 to the number 13, then somebody on the street would know he's had it. The name Andrew Hoffman is important because it has not yet been resolved where he was. We know he talked to the medical aides and told them where to send the body, but that's all we know. Regarding the politics, those are a few of the given facts, and I have a lot more. We could do about 10 or 12 tapes for what I've typed up already this past week, about 80 pages, but we'll do the best we can. An article by Joseph Kraft, syndicated columnist, February the 12th, 1979, titled The Private Lives of Public Men, Scandals Show in the 1980 Campaign. And, of course, they're quick now with the articles, and it reminds us that there's scandals in both parties, that Rockefeller couldn't run when he had his divorce in 1964. He lost to Goldwater because of his divorce. And in 1972, there was Chappaquiddick, so Ted Kennedy couldn't get the nomination in 72. And that Gerald Ford probably can't get it in 1980 because his wife takes drugs, is an alcoholic, and it would be like desertion if he left her. And with Carter, he has problems with Brother Billy, and Burt Lance, he has his problems. And then he concludes, that leaves us with Governor Ronald Reagan. What little I've seen of him suggests a picture book life, wholesome and easy, like an old movie. I'm glad Joseph Kraft clarified with what little I've seen of him, because if he lived here and knew what he did as governor, that would be a different story. Maybe he doesn't want to know those facts. But already the editorials are coming out, and it looks like Reagan is escalating his campaign. There is a big article about opening up offices. He's on the radio at 280 stations. He's in 110 newspapers with columns. And on January 31st, immediately after Rockefeller was dead, Ronald Reagan began his campaign. Reagan steps up his campaign for 1980, and within 3 weeks, the campaign will be rolling. And his first affair, one big affair, will be in New York City with his support by Mr. Rabb, a New York lawyer, a cabinet member under Ike, who's going to have an affair and bring Reagan in contact with the Republicans in New York City. And he's recruiting for his power base all of the Republicans that had voted for Gerald Ford. So that is the politics of assassination. And now he can come into New York City as King of New York, the King of the Republicans, because Rocky is no longer a factor. We'll do more of this on side two of this tape on Rocky.